Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing La Llorona, which is not the curse of La Llorona from a couple of years ago, which is part of the Conjuring extended universe.
Or is it? Who cares? There was some uncertainty on that point. We can say definitively that today's La Llorona is definitely not
at all related.
So no tenuous, wishy-washy.
It was not produced by James Wan.
No, sir.
So that's your first clue.
There's no black ichor coming out of the boogie woman's eyes.
I nearly said the same thing.
Or anything along those lines. None of the
CGI
telltale
black flies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We would understand if you were confused because we did do a podcast episode on the curse of La Llorona some time ago. And that is the one that is part of the James Wan morass.
One big happy family.
And was terrible.
Well, it's a little surprising we don't get more La Llorona movies. I mean, it's as public domain as it gets. It's a folk legend. You know, it's like making movies about Robin Hood. You get like a shitty Robin Hood movie once every 4 to 7 years.
I know there are multiple out there. I remember years ago seeing one on the shelves at Blockbuster.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been made several times, although not quite as ubiquitous as you might expect, given the fact that it is, yes, public domain, and so it's sort of ripe for it. But the, I guess, commercial picture from a couple of years ago was kind of the most high-profile version.
In the States, certainly.
In the States, I guess I can't speak.
Supposed to be La Llorona's big break, and she blew it. Just didn't have that crossover appeal, you know?
Then this film premiered at Sundance back in the non-COVID part of 2020, you know, January. So a lot of buzz around it. And yeah, so that's the film we're talking about now. It follows a retired dictator. The synopsis, we watched it on Shudder because it was acquired by Shudder, is now tagged a Shudder original. The synopsis refers to him as a retired war criminal, about which Matt and I joked extensively. Just a kind of an absurd idea. Anyway, he's an ex-dictator of Guatemala. He conducted a genocide against the indigenous people, and now he's kind of haunted by them in more ways than one.
Right.
That's the basic thrust of the film. It's him, and then he's also got his family around him.
His wife of many years, sort of a mob wife, like an enabler type, a woman who's used to looking the other way. And then his daughter, who appears to be, if not estranged, then not as intimate as they could be. I mean, he keeps, at various points throughout the movie, she's encouraged, oh, why don't you stay here? It's not right for, you know, because it's a daughter, granddaughter. The father's not in the picture. So the family is trying to sort of reabsorb her into its bosom. And she's kind of, for a variety of reasons, not having it. Not least of which is that the family is being hounded by protesters throughout basically the entire runtime. But we'll expound on that shortly.
Yeah, why don't you take it away?
Well, it opens with the general, whose name is Monteverde, Enrique Monteverde, mounting his defense. He's going on trial for war crimes, and it's heavy stuff. I don't know how many yucks there's going to be in this particular episode.
Yeah, no, it's probably going to be a fairly somber episode as they go.
The first paranormal event, the first thing that's kind of our beat happens, he hears crying in the night, goes
which
wandering
is a classic
around.
La Llorona signal.
Oh, sure. And he goes wandering around his estate and sees a mysterious figure and fires at it. You can take the war criminal out of the war, but you can't take the war out of the war criminal, I guess. This is what is meant by a retired war criminal, I guess.
I suppose.
Fish gotta swim. And the figure drops like a sack of potatoes. It looks for sure like it was bang on target. It turns out it was his wife. He narrowly missed her. And so from there on out, his sanity is in question.
Right.
Because no one heard the crying except for him.
Well,
maybe.
Maybe. He has a staff.
Yeah, a bunch of indigenous servants, all of whom are very tight-lipped.
Yeah, and immediately after, he has been disarmed by his bodyguard under protest. They're all being interviewed as a group, like, did anybody hear anything? And everybody's, like, shaking their head, no. But then they start speaking to each other in not Spanish, their language. I forget the name of it. It kept getting tagged in the subtitles.
Yeah, it
so
starts,
I should've
with, starts with a K. That's all I can tell you.
But in any case,
I am such a fucking honky. I thought for a long time it was a character's name, like someone speaking off screen. And then I realized the error of my ways.
The name and the spelling of it reminded me too much of like Quechua. So it sounded like a South American indigenous language.
It is rather close to that.
In any case, they're all shaking their heads no, but then one of them starts speaking to the others in their language, which the Guatemalans of Spanish extraction, of European extraction, cannot understand.
And this language is selectively subtitled throughout the movie. The filmmakers are very coy about letting us parse some of it, but not others.
Yeah. So, saying something along the lines of, you know what the crying means, basically. Like, yeah. they all seem to know rather quickly exactly what's up, and they're kind of like, so how far along is it? Well, he's hearing it, like, in his ear or whatever, which paradoxically apparently means that it's not close yet.
Mm-hmm.
And this leads almost immediately to basically the entire staff saying, we want our last paychecks.
Yeah, they quit en masse. And shortly thereafter, the general is found guilty. So his problems are piling up. But then the highest court in the land, and
the constitutional court, sets the verdict aside.
Yeah. They give him a get out of jail free card, and protesters assemble outside the house basically 24/7.
Yeah, they assemble and then remain there for the rest of the movie, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So the general is in poor health. There's kind of an amusing shot of him standing trial. When the verdict is read, he starts going into some kind of arrest. He's got a IV bag. It reminded me of when all of the geriatric dons are standing trial near the end of Casino. They're all getting wheeled in and out of the courtroom and taking off their ventilator masks so they can conspire with one another.
Well, yeah, that's a very, like, a Pinochet thing. I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure there was, we'll get into it after the break, I'll research this, but there was a military dictator in Guatemala that this guy is probably directly based on.
Yeah.
And it's textbook. All of these guys, whether they're actually in bad health or not, and it seems like this guy, to a certain extent at least, is ill physically. But
Your Honor, as you can see, my poor client.
So decrepit. You know, they roll him in, have him hooked up to an IV and oxygen and everything. It's the same thing like Harvey Weinstein and his walker. I mean, it's all the same garbage.
Well, in terms of like film grammar, what it conveys, whether it's a mob boss or an ex-war criminal, retired war criminal, the point is the same. Like, justice is way overdue. You know, this person is practically out the door, assuming they're, because it's horrifying either way. Obviously, if they're faking their infirmities, then they're a snake. But if they are actually moribund, then it's too little too late. It'd be too little too late no matter what. But what, are you going to throw him in jail for 6 months?
Right.
You know, before he croaks. So it's just a sad sight to see, no matter how you slice it. So there's a harrowing scene of them getting to and from the courthouse, having guys with riot shields herd them through a crowd. They get back to the house. They have blood bags thrown at them, windows broken. And I guess the next event of note is that an indigenous Guatemalan woman arrives at the house. And if I'm not mistaken, she's taken in as like a replacement for the help who quit.
Well, yeah, the kind of head maid, Valeriana, who is also indigenous, but unlike her compatriots, did not quit all at once.
Yeah, she's been with the family for a long, long time, since she was a child.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that later on. But she has reached out to her village saying, like, yeah, I know bunches of people are back there looking for work. I'm sure I can find replacements.
She finds exactly one.
Yeah, this is Alma, who has shown up. She's the new addition to the household staff.
Yeah, she weaves, or the first shot of her, we see her weaving her way through the mob outside and fixing the general who's on an upper story with a creepy stare. Very ominous.
Yes.
So she bunks with Valeriana, takes the top bunk, crucially, because that way we get a very Juon-esque shot
boy,
of her
do we.
Emerging hair first into frame, kind of hanging like a bat from the top bunk, looming over her while she sleeps. Very spooky. We sort of, the rest of the movie takes place in this home, and it's sort of, there's a couple beats that get returned to repeatedly. The wife, the general's wife, is having recurring nightmares in which she's experiencing the atrocities from the perspective of a indigenous Guatemalan being chased through fields and interrogated and held at gunpoint. The granddaughter, his name is Sarah, is bonding with Alma, and so we get a drip feed of stuff about Alma's life that's being confided in Sarah. She's a total mystery to everyone else, and indeed to us. We don't witness a lot of these interactions firsthand. It's more Sarah relaying what she's been told to
her mother,
her mother, or somebody else.
Mostly her mother, yeah. We find out things like, oh yeah, she has two kids. Really? She's so young. Yeah, well, they're dead now.
Right.
Which, again, alarm bells.
We get another scene of the general wandering around at night. It's funny. You commented at this point, was his mustache, his white mustache in the darkness makes it look like he's baring his teeth.
Yes.
It looks like he's snarling. And he's also wearing these sunglasses. And when the light catches them in tandem with the mustache, it gives him like a demonic kind of visage, or animalistic at the very least. He sees Alma in the pool outside, very in her element, you know, La Llorona, classic imagery. And then he finds her in the bathroom. She's bathing or washing her uniform. She's nude in any case. It's composed kind of similarly to the shot of the seductress, the siren in The Shining, who turns into an old crone. You know, mm-hmm. It's that kind of would-be erotic, but actually quite chilling, like peeping Tom moment. And he is taken for a peeping Tom, and his family chastises him because he was just leering at her.
Right.
Life for this family starts to feel more and more Helm's Deep. I mean, from their perspective, obviously my sympathies are with the people outside, but we spend basically the entire movie, as I said, in the house, and you're just constantly hearing drumming and chanting and horns. So there's a very oppressive feeling of invaders at the gate, you know,
right,
to the extent that you share the family's perspective on these matters.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and the following is echoed kind of during the climax, but you do still feel bad for the granddaughter, to a certain extent the daughter, who
uh-huh.
like doesn't want to be there but also feels this familial obligation. You feel bad for,
well, the daughter, Valeriana, at least, right, the daughter at least asks questions and is accused of being a lefty and a communist at one point for doing so.
You don't really feel bad for the wife, and
no,
you certainly don't feel bad for the general, but the other people in the house, there is room for sympathy there.
Yeah, there is an, I guess Sarah would be the Anastasia in this scenario.
Sure.
You know, it does start to feel like a Romanoff kind of situation at points. There's a great scene where the daughter is trying to meditate outside with all of this angry chanting happening just beyond the edge of their yard, or where they've got guards
beyond
posted.
Beyond the gates, beyond
right,
the fences.
And she's, you know, like a whatever lotus position, trying to connect with her chi or what have you. And her mother comes outside and puts fucking cucumber slices on her face and lies down on a lawn chair. And the two of them are just chillaxing. It was a great illustration of the power of denial, you know, that you can really acclimate to any situation, no matter how dire, you know, provided it has time to become monotonous. I imagine all of the chanting and horns and drums are just white noise for them at this point, or they're doing their damnedest to shut it out. And they have a conversation out there on the lawn about how the wife suspects that Valeriana is an illegitimate child of the general's.
Yeah. He just showed up with her one day when the daughter, Natalia, I don't know if we've thrown out her name yet, but when she was very young and Valeriana was scarcely older than she was. Yeah, he just turned up.
Yeah, and we know from the trial portion of the movie that weaponized rape is one of the most heinous of the allegations leveled at the old regime and at the general in particular. So we can imagine the circumstances under which she might have been conceived.
Mm-hmm.
There's a spooky moment, several spooky moments involving Alma and the granddaughter, Sarah. Alma is trying to teach Sarah how to hold her breath underwater, which, again, if you know.
Right.
There's another scene where the two of them are standing by a window and they're looking at flyers, which the protesters have been somehow getting into their yard and onto the premises, of posters of people who were murdered or disappeared, vanished without a trace. And they see a face on one of the flyers and look into the crowd and see that man standing amidst the protesters. So some unquiet spirits have infiltrated the ranks of the people outside, and it's a creepy moment because it begs the question, how many other not alive people are milling around out there? What's the living to ghost ratio? I'd like to know, because it seems like they're there, like I said, 24/7, night and day. It's a nonstop vigil. So that kind of raises some unsettling questions. We learn some disquieting things about Alma. She and Valeriana are scrubbing at a bunch of black mold that the general found behind his headboard of his bed, and Valeriana attributes that to black magic and wants to exorcise him. She's the kind of resident, you know, in a James Wan movie, she'd be played by like Michael Peña or something, you know, the resident exorcist,
or the guy who played Tuco in Breaking Bad, as the case may be.
Right, yeah.
As the case was in the other one.
Yeah, I was trying to place him. I saw something where Michael Peña played an exorcist, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, the Vatican tapes.
Was that what that was? Okay.
Yeah.
All those fucking possession movies sort of blur together. In any case, as they're scrubbing at this black mold infestation, Valeriana is asking some loaded questions. Oh, well, no one in the village has ever heard of you. How old are you exactly? And Alma is not very forthcoming. Still a cipher.
Well, she doesn't come right out with the how old are you question. She's like, where do you come from? Alma's like, from the deepest part of the mountain, like by the military camp,
where the river is.
It's like, by the military camp. Yes, I lived there until the killings began, and that's when Valeriana rightly, I think, asks, how old are you?
Right.
Because these killings, this genocide, took place 35 years prior to the events of the film. So Valeriana is middle-aged. Alma, if she was fleeing the killings, would be the same. So again, red flag, big time.
Sarah is either sleepwalking or in some kind of a trance, or at any rate, behaving oddly at Alma's behest. She steals her grandfather's oxygen tank and wanders into the pool. He pursues her out there, sees Alma in the water, and starts firing. I thought for sure we were going to get a smile, you son of a...
I thought maybe.
Incident here, but he just wings her. Not a great shot, actually, on the basis of what we see in this movie. And
he is also like 85 years old.
Well, the spirit is willing, I'm sure. The flesh is weak. And his whole family basically tackles him to the ground.
Natalia starts pointing the gun at him, justifiably angry because he just shot her daughter.
Right. And this is where Valeriana sort of starts calling the shots, you know, does she call for salt or sugar?
Sugar.
Yeah, but in any case, we're lighting candles, we're getting a circle of some powdery substance on the ground.
Cocaine.
Yeah. Hey, good time, not a long time. The protesters, well, the specters.
The ghost ones.
Yeah, right. The specters, the non-corporeal protesters, have infiltrated the house. Valeriana is reciting this incantation to keep them at bay in her native tongue. And she's really throwing the general under the bus.
Well, yeah.
Rightfully so.
Like I was saying earlier, the movie shows some sympathy for members of the family who aren't him, because she's saying, like, it's not right to hold innocence responsible for what he did. And if you have beef with him, obviously she doesn't say beef, but if you have a problem with him, you should take it up with him. And just a lot of verbiage in this direction. And then Carmen, the wife, goes into a fugue, basically has a waking version of one of her dreams, and this culminates in, again, she looks like herself in the dream, but she's in the persona of an indigenous woman, and she's speaking in this indigenous tongue. She's being dragged to the river and interrogated. Where's your husband? Where are the gorillas? Where did they go? And she's like, I don't understand. I'm not a gorilla. My husband isn't a gorilla. I don't know where they went. Please, the army is going to drown her children unless she talks. And when she can't tell them anything because she doesn't know, they proceed to start drowning the children. And then the general, who is the one interrogating her, shoots her in the face, but nothing happens to her. And then she looks to her side, and Alma is laying on the ground, bullet through the forehead.
Yeah, it's as if the shot finally dislodges her from Alma's body, which she's been inhabiting in all of these visions.
Right.
And then she lunges, still in the flashback, dream, fugue, whatever. She lunges at her husband, who just pulled the trigger, and strangles him. Cut to the living room, candles, sugar on the floor, and she's just strangled him, IRL, so to speak.
And apparently to death, because we immediately cut to his funeral the next day or during the day.
Indeed,
at some point.
The very first shot of the movie I thought was set at a wake, although I wasn't positive. It's just it starts on a tight shot of that character, the wife, whispering some kind of prayer, and it pulls out. You see the whole family. There's kind of a funereal. They're all dressed, you know, somberly.
Mm-hmm.
And now we catch up with that frame narrative. Finally, they're all laying him to rest, and good fucking riddance.
We get a little bit of a coda here after the funeral, because one of his fellow junta members is walking to the bathroom. There's a scene relatively early on in the movie that we skipped over where basically he's meeting with all of his other generals, his fellow generals, the rest of the ruling group, again, the military junta, who, like him, they're all old men now, and they're kind of strategizing how they're going to behave, you know, at the trial or their trials or whatever. So we follow one of these at the end of the movie after the funeral. He goes to the bathroom, and he's at the urinal or whatever, and the other two people in the room clear out, wash their hands, whatever, and then as he's peeing, he starts hearing this sobbing, and then water starts overflowing out of all the urinals and flooding the floor, and he backs out of the room.
And obviously, La Llorona is always associated with water and running water because of the motif of the river and of drowning and of weeping also.
Right.
But throughout
face
the
water,
throughout the
will.
Movie, yeah. It's a normal human expression used by earthlings like you and I. Throughout the movie, some of the earliest and kind of most rote paranormal happenings have to do with like taps turning themselves on and stuff like that. So it could just be an overflowing toilet in his case, but obviously it portends the fact that his head is next on the chopping block.
Yes. So with that, we get the cut to black and the end credits. So we will go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some more thoughts afterwards.
¿Oyó a alguien llorar?
Hay que leer la raya al tirarme. Y cogen que se cogen y se ir.
Los sirvientes se quieren ir. Todos tienen miedo.
Este encierro nos está enfermando.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show. And we're back. So, true to my word, I did do some research, and I was more or less on the mark. The military dictator of Guatemala from 82 to 83 was named Jose Efrén Ríos Montt, and he was prosecuted for war crimes during that tenure. War crimes very similar to the ones shown in this film. So basically, Monteverde is just a stand-in for him, pretty much straight up. I didn't go really deep into the research. I believe he was convicted. I don't know if his verdict was set aside like it was in the film. It would make sense, given how much overlap there is between this film and reality. But point being, this comes from a place of real-life genocide and real-life war crimes. So it's obviously got a lot going on in that department. It's a prominent thread in the history and present-day politics throughout South America, the conflict between people of mostly European extraction whose ancestors came over as colonists either hundreds of years ago or more recently, kind of being at odds with the indigenous population, some of whom have integrated into the society that has been set up by the Europeans and some of whom have not. Not in every country has it resulted in outright genocide like it did in Guatemala and some other countries, but again, sometimes it did, and obviously it's a tragedy.
Yeah, and when those atrocities happened under the guise of anti-communist activities, you know, or then all too often the U.S. was all too happy to either participate or tacitly condone it or look the other way at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, like war crimes committed in the name of anti-communism, that's not even limited to, it's not limited to Guatemala, that's not even limited to South America. That was just a worldwide thing. So this movie is trying to reckon with a lot of weighty historical stuff in that vein.
Yeah, and it doesn't bring the U.S. into it. It keeps things fairly close to home.
Right. I mean, there's enough places to point fingers without laying blame at the United States' feet also, although that is, again, justified.
Well, the film is weighty enough without, like, stepping onto a global stage. You know?
Yeah, so it doesn't, there's enough going on without also needing to address the colonial issue. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because so often horror films with this kind of political weight to them are about the victims of atrocities like this. His House would be an example of that, mm-hmm. that we reviewed not long ago.
Sure.
So rarely watch horror movies about the perpetrators. You know, it's like Downfall by way of The Shining. You know, it's really, I've never seen anything quite like it. I've seen things that are close enough, and I'll talk about that during the recommendation section. But this movie is trying something fairly ambitious, so I appreciate that. It gives it real heft, knowing that this is not just some grunt, you know, it's not like he was involved in a massacre and it's haunted him ever since. He was, you know, the architect of thousands and thousands of deaths.
Yeah, and it's only haunted him to the extent that people are trying to hold him responsible.
Well, that's the other thing I like, is we discern very quickly that this guy does not have a dirty conscience. You know, he sleeps like a baby at night, breathing problems notwithstanding.
Right.
So there's two ways that you can take material like this, and the movie sort of flirts with one of them, but the other is never even touched on. One being maybe he's senile, and there's mm-hmm. a little bit of that when he's stumbling around at night and seeing things. And then the other one is, oh, his conscience is troubling him. And we just know right away, no, it isn't.
No. He has no conscience.
So right away, the movie robs you of an easy out when it comes to dismissing the... You know right away that what you're seeing is supernatural, because the most convenient, tried-and-true psychological explanation, the subjective psychological horror explanation, has basically just been thrown out.
Yeah.
And his senility doesn't play a huge role in the movie because very quickly other people start seeing things and hearing things. So you know the ground that you're on pretty much immediately. And while I appreciate ambiguity in some situations, I think here, because so little happens for so much of the movie, it is just them living with the daily stress of this mob of peaceful protesters outside. Something of a contradiction in terms, mob of peaceful. But they are a little bit
crowd.
Of crowd. Yeah, right.
But they are, yes. As you
they
said,
do exude a lot of menace.
Yes. when they're coming in, you know, in the ambulance or whatever, the scene we talked about earlier that's kind of harrowing, one of the guards is saying, like, it's a peaceful protest, it's a peaceful protest, like, mm-hmm. trying to calm them down, and then the protesters start, like, pounding on all sides of the ambulance, and then eventually he's forced to admit, well, maybe not so peaceful.
That was spectacular just because you're locked in, you're in, there's no exterior shots until you emerge with them from the back of the ambulance. So when you hear the palms and fists and cans of soup potentially raining down on the ambulance, it's like a hailstorm has just materialized out of nowhere. It feels like it sounds like a force of nature, and in a way that's what it is. Anyway, the fact that so much of the movie is relatively mundane, you kind of have to know that there are actual ghosts getting up to ghostly antics. Otherwise, this is not a movie that can afford to be coy about whether it's going to be paranormal or psychological. I guess right. That's what it, because a lot of it is fairly down to earth and just about, like I said, these people living with the omnipresent stress of the chanting and the drumming and the horns.
Yeah, living with the consequences of the patriarch's actions.
Yeah, right, and the flyers coming over the gates and whatever else.
Yeah.
And the ghost is in the, you know, La Llorona is the La Llorona. El Nino is Spanish for you, whatever, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, we did that last time. Or maybe the time before, I don't know.
Chris Farley's SNL tenure looms large in my imagination to this day. La Llorona is in their presence right away.
They let her in.
Yeah, right, exactly. In a vampire sort of way. You know, she has permission to be there. So I think it is important that you as a viewer know right away, oh, this is going to get extraordinary. You know, this is going to get supernatural.
Right. Yeah, for the most part, the senility thing isn't really used as a... It's more used for dramatic irony purposes. It's more used to kind of forestall the other characters coming to the same conclusion that we do relatively quickly. They hold on to the senility idea for much longer.
Yeah, well, and it doesn't really muddy the waters for the viewer meaningfully. And I think it also serves to make the general look kind of pathetic. I mean, he does spend, when he's wandering around at night, his glasses and teeth stash notwithstanding, he does look just like a kind of flabby, over-the-hill pensioner, you know, a retired war criminal.
Well, yeah, and he's not a large man,
no,
so that makes him even less imposing.
Rather diminutive.
Yeah, you know, maybe 5'6" or something. Like, his wife is taller than him. That's one thing that you kind of notice. Right,
yeah,
off the bat.
And the movie puts her through her paces too. She looks to age about 40 years over the course of the film, and it's just to do with her letting her hair down. She stops getting enough sleep, stops applying makeup. So that's what makes the visions, the flashbacks, the dreams so arresting visually, is that she looks even more incongruous because she's in a nightgown.
Right.
She's light-skinned and elderly. And she's being dragged around and treated like she's this 20-something gorilla. Or
would be
gorilla,
accused,
yeah.
Accused gorilla, yeah.
The movie is very deft, I think, in the way that it kicks off with the trial. You only get the testimony of one victim, who's referred to as Witness 82, horrifyingly.
Yeah.
We don't need to hear the other 81 to know that this guy is absolute garbage. She talks as a lengthy monologue. Like the opening shot, it starts tight on her face and then pulls out. She's talking about her home being burned, her cattle being massacred.
Burned, I think, also.
Yes.
Like, presumably, perhaps burned alive.
Mm-hmm. And being raped and terrorized in every conceivable manner. And she and a bunch of other indigenous women in the courthouse are wearing these blue veils that have sort of a floral pattern on them, and it looks they look like drowned Ophelias. You know, it looks like there's a river, you know, like a veil of tears, like coursing over their faces. It's kind of a stunning image, and obviously makes sense in this particular film. It's thematically resonant.
Right.
Because you get the sense that a horror show like this, a war like this, a genocide like this would have produced a lot of La Lloronas, not just one.
Yes. I appreciate that this movie elected to take the La Llorona legend and then sort of infuse it with all of this almost like racial trauma memory stuff. Because the traditional ghost story, essentially, and the one to which the 2018 or 2019, I can't remember which film, I think 2019, hews very closely to is, and I think there are multiple versions, but one of them is this woman marries a rancher, has two kids, sees her husband fooling around with another woman, and then takes the kids to the river and drowns them, and then weeps about it. And so
she's a mad woman. Like, where are my children? When she's the one who offed them. So you're dealing with a lunatic, you know, and like a Lizzie Borden type, and that's a different kind of. It's also, I think, folklorically, like an eat your vegetables or kind of thing, you know, like you behave yourself or La Llorona will get you.
Right. And so it's just a straight up non-specific ready-made ghost story. It doesn't.
And there's, you know, like a woman scorned element to it. I think in some tellings, it's a younger woman that her husband is having his dalliance with. So there's like female vanity mixed up in it. And all of that is absent from this iteration.
Right. And basically the upshot of what I'm trying to get at is there has to be this kind of rigmarole about how La Llorona ends up haunting the protagonists of a more typical La Llorona film.
Uh-huh.
Whereas this is like chickens are coming home to roost. Like
big time.
The quote unquote victim, and the air quotes are very heavy here, the quote unquote victim of the haunting, he's the textbook, like, obvious target.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it's him that La Llorona is coming after. It has to be.
And I was surprised and thrilled by the final flashback when we get the children being drowned in the river, crucially not by their own mother. Like we said, that's probably the biggest divergence from the original folktale, because I thought that the whole La Llorona thing in this movie was going to be a little more abstract. You know,
yeah.
You would get the crying at night and a little bit of a water motif with the taps and the bathtub and the pool outside, and that would be that. But knowing that Alma does have something of a, it's this is going to sound kind of facile, it's like a gritty update of a La Llorona origin story, you know.
What you're saying.
You know what I mean? In like a Batman reboot kind of way. It's like, well, how do we juice this? You know, how do we take the basic narrative elements of the La Llorona story and update it for modern times? And
but it's like a Nolan quality Batman reboot rather than a Snyder quality, I guess.
Yeah, right.
We'll mark it like that.
Yeah, I'm definitely not trying to
sell Martha. You know? Uh-huh. What were your children's names?
Yeah.
Martha. Both of them?
Twins, presumably.
Boy and a girl, both named Martha. Twins. Yeah, no, again, I think it gives it a lot more, I don't know, I mean, we've already said heft, but it gives it some immediacy that, again, this kind of real-life atrocity, series of atrocities, have engendered this essentially vengeful spirit. And also, I like that the vengeful spirit is very understated.
Yes.
Like, Alma could not be more placid if she tried. Again, there's no black ichor pouring out of every orifice. There's no scream. I think she screams in the immediate aftermath of the Peeping Tom sequence. But she's like shouting, come in here, get him out of here, help me. He's leering at me or whatever, instead of a screaming ghost rage thing. Distended mouth bullshit.
Yeah, her face never gets like chalky and corpsey, and she never levitates, any of that stuff. She doesn't ever reach into that bag of tricks.
She barely even makes a noise most of the time.
Yeah, she just sort of drifts about, and her face is placid, but not in a contented way. I mean, she looks like numb to the world. I mean, right. She looks kind of just permanently checked out, which makes sense given what she's been through. But
and
she's not
the fact that she's dead.
She's not relishing any of this. She doesn't even seem to enjoy punishing the general. She would rather, it seems, not be there. She would rather have lived a nice, long, happy life with her offspring.
Who lived longer, happier lives.
Yeah, right. So it's just...
But failing that, this is what needs to be done.
Yeah, so it's very melancholy, the whole haunting aspect, and that's true in a lot of Mexican and Spanish horror films. Devil's Backbone being the first example that springs to mind, you know, mournful ghosts.
Well, yeah, and not to mention Pan's Labyrinth has, isn't it the Spanish Civil War going on around it?
Yeah.
And, you know, all the
partisans attendant, getting, yeah, killed.
All the attendant war crimes going on at that time.
Yeah.
It's definitely a
the human villain
kind of a shared thread.
Yeah, the human villain in Devil's Backbone is also something of a aspiring fascist flunky, if memory serves, sort of a enterprising young would-be Francoist goon.
Right, but the guy in Pan's Labyrinth, he's like an actual
yes.
employed fascist.
Yes.
And is it the girl's
adopted father?
Adopted father, yeah. That's right.
He's like yeah. the wicked stepfather as opposed to the stepmother you would normally get in a fairy tale.
Right.
But still very much a fairy tale trope. So as I predicted, not exactly a bucket of laughs.
No.
The only funny thought that came to me during the movie was that it was not a good movie to watch when you feel like you have to take a leak because there's this just recurrent running water motif running through the whole movie, and I kept thinking, you know, I'm actually glad I didn't see this in a movie theater with a fat old thing of Coca-Cola in my armrest, you know, in
right.
my cup holder, because I might have had a medical situation on my hands.
Like, I might have
if I tried
done
to...
damage to my prostate.
Yeah, right. Well, and then that's sort of borne out when the wife, the general's wife, I don't think we talked about this, she starts wetting the bed, or does at least once. She
yeah.
wakes up from her first nightmare having soiled herself. And so I thought, like, yeah, tell me about it. And then the fucking movie ends with the other general literally pissing at a urinal.
Yeah.
And then there's water up to his ankles. And I just thought, oh, my God, there's something going on here. There's something. This movie is about, I don't know, something to do with bladders. I have no further insight than that, which is to say that I have basically no insight at all. Maybe I should have just had a bathroom break partway through and not harangued you with this weird harangue.
No, I mean, it's, you know, I also cannot come up with anything more in depth to say about it, but there is, again, water, running water, urination. It's all over the place in this movie. You're not off base there.
Yeah.
But again, like you, I don't really know what to say beyond that. I don't know what it's pertaining to. I mean, I guess the fact that the kids were drowned, you know, the fact that there's so much recurring water now in the general's experience, both generals, as it turns out, and also, you know, the general's wife. That's, again, I guess maybe an outgrowth of chickens coming home to roost. You're being haunted and also water all the time.
Yeah, well, and just, I don't know, the fact that obviously the flooding bathroom at the end is an ocean of tears rising to consume him, all the pain that he's inflicted on this country. But I think, I don't know, bathrooms are a sight of unease in horror movies. I don't know if this is actually true. This might be one of those just apocryphal movie facts that gets repeated until it's taken as gospel truth. But I think Psycho has a claim to being the first film to ever depict a toilet being flushed.
Yeah, I have heard that
right.
repeatedly. I can believe that. That seems like a weird thing that movies during the code era
uh-huh.
would have just been like, no, it's bodily functions.
Right.
Never.
Well, and she's flushing a torn up scrap of paper and it's plot relevant. So it's as not gross as Hitchcock could make it while still in making
but,
the audience
but
feel unclean.
Hitch is like, fuck the censors, you
right.
know, basically. And then pre-code, like, it probably just wouldn't have occurred to anybody, like, why do we need to waste film on shooting a toilet being flushed?
Right.
And then, yeah, Psycho came around as the code era was kind of breaking down. So,
well, I already talked about the Shining bathroom scene, which is among the eeriest in that film. You know, I'm trying to rationalize my thing with busted bladders. You know, I think that it's a place where you go to do private business. And so I think that, Japanese urban legends, ghostly urban legends are all about, there's 100,000 different Japanese ghosts that can attack you in the bathroom.
Oh yeah.
with their own lore and their own discrete characteristics. So I don't think, maybe it's just sort of a weird totemic thing like that. I don't know.
Yeah, Matt, I'm going to let you off the hook. I don't think this is just your own private hang up. This isn't just you being weird about bathrooms. This is a thing. It's a thing that's in this movie, and it's a thing out there in the cultural ether.
There it is.
Or the multicultural ether, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give you a pass because, you know, I have the right to do that.
Right.
It's my prerogative.
Well, yeah, we don't have a third co-host. If we agree on something, then
it's fact.
Yeah.
It's just how it works.
I've seen a grand total of 3 La Llorona movies. Curse of La Llorona, which is
trash.
Dreck. And today's film, which is quite good. And one from, I want to say 1933, early 30s. It's supposedly the first Mexican horror film. It's in any case, a very early Mexican sound film and a horror film at that, called just La Llorona, same as this one. So I'm going to formally recommend that. It doesn't have that much to do with this movie, certainly in terms of the political heft. It has very little common ground with this movie. I'm going to recommend it anyway just because of the obvious shared characteristic, which is that it's about the same boogeyman entity. Much of the middle stretch is scarcely a horror movie at all. It's set in the past, and it's about that film's own original take on the La Llorona legend. It kind of turns into like a Mexican Errol Flynn movie. There's a lot of swashbuckling and sort of costumed intrigue. I mean, I enjoyed that. I think that the stuff on either side of it is a little bit more my bread and butter. The final shot is pretty excellent. It's one of those old-timey horror movies that isn't explicitly supernatural for the most part. It's more like, oh, is this like a serial killer who's modeling their crimes on La Llorona, or is this the actual La Llorona? I don't know if you've seen The Leopard Man. It's a Val Lewton, like it's like a post Cat People Val Lewton movie, and it's a little bit of an anomaly because it's not actually about like a panther man or a leopard man or a cat person. It's about, it's ultimately revealed, spoilers, that it's just some maniac who's like fashioned like panther claw implements for himself that he goes out and does murder with. La Llorona kind of toes that line too, but the final shot is a little bit of a curveball, and I was really taken in by it. So that's my formal recommendation. I have 2 other sort of secondary recommendations, which are a little bit more relevant as far as the political stuff goes. I was trying to think the whole time I was watching the movie, like what I was saying earlier about how movies like this are so often told from the perspective of the victims, the people on the bottom, like the refugees in his house, for example. Mm-hmm. I was trying to think of any other example of a sort of politically coded horror movie like this, where it's about a dictator getting his comeuppance. And I thought of 2, and neither of them are full-fledged movies in their own right. One is a sequence from Tales from the Hood, which is about a former Klansman who I think is running for office. He's like a senator now or something, seeking election or maybe re-election, and living in a big plantation house that's haunted by the spirits of slaves who were brutally murdered and obviously treated brutally during their lives on the property. And so he gets his comeuppance, and there's an episode of The Twilight Zone called, I think, Death's Head Revisited, where a fugitive Nazi ex-concentration camp commandant returns to Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen or somewhere as a tourist, basically just to gloat and take a victory lap around the gas chambers, be, you know, just a smug prick for half an hour until he too gets supernatural justice visited upon him. So those are both quite good. Obviously, they're both just pieces of a larger anthology media of some kind, so they're relatively short and digestible, and I would recommend both of those. Rod Serling kind of loved stories like that. There's another kind of weird, very much not classic Twilight Zone episode about a thinly disguised Castro who gets obsessed with a paranormal mirror that tells the future, I think. But that's also about a dictator who's laid low by paranormal means. I think that one's just called The Mirror. Anyway, these stories are out there, but I haven't seen a feature film meditate on that theme and that premise with quite such aplomb as La Llorona. So definitely seek it out. And the one from the 30s, too, because it's a fascinating little piece of horror history.
So I'm going to take the easy way out and recommend a Devil's Backbone Pan's Labyrinth double feature. I say easy way out because they're Guillermo del Toro movies, and both relatively well-known ones at that. I mean, obviously, Pan's Labyrinth was his breakthrough movie. Everybody knows it. But at the same time, frankly, I don't hear people talk about Pan's Labyrinth quite as much as they used to. Mm-hmm. And so I,
yeah, GDT
a flimsy
is
pretext that may be, but I'm gonna hang my hat on that.
Well, and Devil's Advocate is very much the B
Devil's
side
backbone.
To Devil's Vanity. He's a tight ass.
He's a sadist.
I cannot control myself. I'm so very sorry. Devil's Backbone is very much the B-side to Pan's Labyrinth's A-side, so if people don't talk about Pan's Labyrinth, they definitely don't talk about Devil's Backbone. Although GDT is still very much the golden boy, so
sure.
But you hear about him and how great he is talked about,
well, it's
in broad terms more often than specific movies, which I find sort of strange.
Right.
He has his fingers in a lot of pies. That's part of it. He produces a lot of stuff.
He produces a lot of stuff, and he's become kind of a larger-than-life character unto himself.
In sort of a latter-day Alfred Hitchcock sort of way, where his name connotes a genre unto itself.
Right. And not to mention that he also just keeps churning out really good newer movies. It's not just like, oh, he made Pan's Labyrinth, and then he like keeps making movies that are still pretty good. Like, Shape of Water is
the
fucking
best
great
picture winner. Yeah.
Yeah, justifiably so. It's not a crash or what have you. So anyway, all that pretext being said, I'm again gonna recommend Pan's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone. They're both set in Spain, either immediately prior to, in the case of Devil's Backbone, or during the Second World War, as in the case of Pan's Labyrinth. They both deal with, and I mean, even though Devil's Backbone is pre-Second World War, it is during the Spanish Civil War, so they're both wartime movies about, at least in part, the trauma of children going through periods of war and dealing with that. So that is sort of the thematic connection to La Llorona, besides them just being Spanish language horror or horror adjacent films.
Yeah, and the looming specter of fascist, anti-communist violence in Pan's Labyrinth especially. But I think that's an element of Devil's Backbone too. I talked about how the villain in that film is sort of a proto-fascist in the way that he operates and the way that he could, the kind of machismo that he exudes.
Right. So those are both great movies. And like I said, Del Toro keeps churning out great movies on the regular, so sometimes you forget about the great movies he already churned out, and you shouldn't. If you haven't seen them, obviously, fucking go now. Stop listening to this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Watching those two movies is a much better use of your time, frankly. And even if you've seen them, you probably haven't seen them in a while, so check them out again.
And in the interest of getting back to what I was saying a while back about how, you know, the U.S. backed or endorsed a lot of these atrocities in Latin America, Michael Shannon's character in Shape of Water is very much a variation on this same theme. I mean,
yes,
he is of a piece with the villains in Pan's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone. He's very much the, like, his take on the G-man is very much like a kind of a stiff upper lip, sort of iron backboned, like, fascist archetype.
Right.
Who's like terminally square is how I would describe his character in that film. He's sort of just like the curdled heart of 50s Americana. It's I think the most well-realized part of that whole movie. He's great.
He is. He often is.
Yes.
So anyway, now that we've given you some recommendations, I think it's time to wrap things up. So until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I am Matt Girondaisi.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from La Llorona Official Trailer HD, a Shudder original, uploaded by Shudder. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, March 28th, and we will be discussing the latest example of the Jewish demon subgenre, The Vigil. See you then.